Hello, welcome everyone. My name is Shannon Hayden with the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS. And on behalf of Karen Von Hippel, our co-director in the back there in the Carnegie Corporation of New York, we'd like to welcome Martin Tisney from the TIRI organization, who's here with us today to talk about integrity in post-conflict settings. Martin and his team have just completed research in 8 different post-conflict settings on issues of integrity, things like accountability, professionalism, and corruption control, with the central premise that an emphasis on integrity in post-conflict settings can both help mitigate the risk of sliding back into open conflict and increase the likelihood of sustainable and effective recovery. Martin comes to us from a number of different organizations, including the International Crisis Group, Chatham House, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and
the
Open Society Institute in Budapest. Yeah. So thank you, Martin, and looks like we'll have time for a presentation and some questions from the audience.
Okay, so about half an hour. Right?
Yes.
Thank you. Whoa, did I do that?
No, Karen did.
Thanks. Thank you very much. A couple of just provisos before I start the presentation. One of them is that the work that I'm going to present now is the result of 2 years' work that we've done with local organizations in post-war settings. TIRI's a non-government, we're not a think tank, we're a non-governmental organization. And we've been working to try and understand what the perspective on corruption and anti-corruption looked like from the field in 8 countries, in 8 post-war reconstruction countries. So before I go into too much detail, I just want to tell you what I want to talk about today. Starting with a brief explanation of what we do and what the Network for Integrity and Reconstruction is. Going on to a theory we have on phases in reconstruction and where particular risks might lie and the relation between those risks and notions of corruption accountability. So then my 2 other sections is talking about corruption, what are the risks of corruption in post-war settings, what has the anti-corruption policy response been, then to move on to accountability mechanisms. What type of accountability mechanism are there, what has the international community strengthened, what was there in the first place, and what can we work with? To then finish with a few recommendations. So we started this work a couple of years ago with NGOs, firstly in 3 countries, in Sierra Leone, in Lebanon, and Bosnia. What was interesting is we started the work with the premise, is corruption different? Are the challenges to fighting corruption in post-war settings different? Now, what was interesting is in the first place, most of the organizations said, actually, no, they're not. You know, we have risks, challenges, which are quite similar to most other developmental settings. Now, we started a small project, a small publication that came out 2.5 years ago now, where we said, well, actually, the risks are different, and for 4 main reasons, right? The first reason was this, what we called at the time the spending imperative, the fact that a large amount of funds were spent in, for the second reason, states that were relatively weak, so weak institutional infrastructures. The third reason, the nature of the projects in reconstruction settings, the fact that we're talking about a large amount of construction projects, which are particularly prone to corruption in most settings, so especially so in fragile state settings. And the fourth one was the relatively poor coordination of the aid in those settings. Now, what's interesting in what happened over the past couple of years is from a relatively narrow focus on corruption, we changed our analysis to analysis on what we term integrity, which I'll talk about during the presentation, which is essentially a combination of accountability, the need for accountability, transparency, corruption control, and competence. Competence being essentially the ability to get things done, to have results. So at this point, just to tell you where we've been working in Afghanistan, East Timor, Sierra Leone, Mozambique in Africa, the West Bank, Gaza, Lebanon, Bosnia and Kosovo. And really part of this project was a capacity building project. Part of the challenge was to find organizations to work with and build their research capacities over time. And I have a short leaflet here. Our aim was to build a south-south network of organizations that had the capacity to do research on these particular issues and that could exchange knowledge between post-war countries. At this point, the knowledge transfer mechanism in terms of lessons learned is very much from the donor perspective. I mean, people such as the people in this room, we go from countries and then have an understanding of what happened in East Timor, that influences what happens in Afghanistan, etc. But the actual knowledge transfer within those countries and between countries is relatively poor and remains relatively poor, we would argue. Now, What I will present today is based on three things that we did in each one of those countries. The first one was an analysis of the actors in reconstruction. So who are the different actors? Donors. What type of donors? What were they funding? How were they funding it? The government, but also NGOs, international NGOs, contractors, local NGOs. Just a brief analysis of the different actors in those settings, their incentives, the challenges they faced. The second, and by far the largest piece of research that we have on each one of those countries, is something that in the anti-corruption sort of jargon is called the National Integrity System Survey, which is essentially an analysis of integrity institutions, which we define as these are the judiciary, legislature, electoral commissions, but also the media, civil society. I'm looking at two sides for each one of those institutions, the legislation behind them, so the laws, what happens in practice. Now, the traditional methodology is to have a freeze frame, essentially what do the state of integrity institutions look like in Mozambique today. What we did was a little bit different. We called it a reconstruction, National Integrity System Survey. We wanted to have an understanding of what the evolution was and an understanding of what the sequencing was, where the priorities were. When and how did we start to fund the judiciary in Afghanistan and why? Those were the questions that we asked that aren't part of the traditional methodology. And then the first point, a case study. Case studies that our partners wanted to look at in more detail. One of them was of the National Solidarity Program, which I'm sure most of you are aware of in Afghanistan. There have been many case studies of the National Solidarity Program, which is a large-scale community development program in the country, but very few looking at accountability mechanisms within the NSP, which has been our focus. And also case studies such as looking at the role of the Central Election Commission in West Bank and Gaza in Palestine in 2005 and early 2006. So to talk about the similarities between the countries, obviously there are huge differences between those countries, but in order to be able to compare them, we wanted to have an understanding of what was similar. So firstly, three things that I mentioned earlier. They share the threat of a return to large-scale violence, the weakness of the state, and the scale, speed, and nature of reconstruction assistance that comes to those countries. Now, those are the countries that we chose, and it partly informed our choice. Now, our analysis is what we call a mismatch between aid flow, state capacities, and development needs. Now, a certain amount, I mean, most of this research has not been done, and I'll skip this, has not been done by us, but by others, most notably Paul Collier at Oxford and others, saying three things. First of all, that development needs in those countries. Now, the graph doesn't mean that the needs are less intense in the early stages, but the diversity of the need grows. From needs based around security needs, humanitarian needs, they grow to incorporate more needs, education, etc. Now, as is by now relatively well known, and that confirmed by the studies that we've looked at, international financial assistance tends to be front-loaded in those countries. And compared with the absorptive capacity of the government and society, that gradually grows. Now, this point has been made before. Our interest is in the discrepancy between these two moments, this one and that one. The first one is what we call the potlatch, in a term that we've borrowed from anthropology, and which is a ceremony in some North American First Nations where one gives, you give in excess. And the potlatch for us is important for three different reasons. It combines high expectations on the part of the public in those settings, high corruption risks, which I'll go into in more detail, and comparatively low demands for accountability. Now, to us, this is interesting because it compares to the second point, which we call the late awakening, which is interesting for a couple of different reasons. One of them is that demands for accountability grew over time in the countries that we looked at. And when I'm talking about demands for accountability, I mean both internal demands for accountability as well as external demands for accountability. So accountability of the funds vis-à-vis the donors' principles, so the UK Parliament, Congress, etc., and internal demands for accountability in order to account for what has happened. The argument being once the famous window of opportunity in those countries is over, people will then want to demand account for what has happened. Now, the reason why we're interested in this in the first stage, and I'll come back to this, is that in the few countries where we actually have data, the public's perceptions of corruption grow over time. And we have a period which we think is particularly dangerous and destabilizing, has a real destabilizing potential in those countries, where if the government is corrupt and is seen to be corrupt and loses the trust of the people to agree, combined with the capacity of opposition to the government, of credible internal critique, to essentially use these internal demands for accountability as political fuel, the threat of destabilization is high. And what's interesting is that the figure of 50% of countries reverting to conflict 10 years after the signature of a peace settlement has actually been mirrored. I mean, there hasn't been open conflict, but it has been mirrored in a small degree in our countries. Since we started working, East Timor, the situation in East Timor, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Lebanon has got significantly worse. And we would be arguing that in part, this is not the only explanation, but one of the explanations is this one. And most famously, groups like Hamas use transparency and accountability to discourse extremely effectively. Hezbollah does to a degree, the Taliban do to a degree. And you could also, looking at the framework of integrity, accountability, competence, and corruption control, use that lens to understand what was happening and what continues to happen in East Timor in the sort of frustration with the government, the Akatiri government, in the spring of last year. Now, I don't want to take too much time. What I want to talk about now is, if one assumes that corruption and accountability are important variables in post-war settings, what does that really mean? So I want to talk first about corruption and what the anti-corruption policy response has been. Now, the thing really to mention, to bear in mind, is that there's incredibly little research on the nature of corruption threats in post-war settings. I was in Kabul last summer, and we were talking with the UK Department for International Development, and they were saying, listen, this is great. Why haven't we done it before? Why did we wait for 4.5 years? So some of this might seem relatively obvious, but it's important to bear in mind. The first one is we need to look at pre-reconstruction patterns of corruption. Now, it's one thing to say that there are significant corruption risks in reconstruction, but we also have to have a better understanding of what happened before. For example, in Sierra Leone, patterns of corruption from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s, how these led to the outbreak of war, and how some of those patterns still exist in Sierra Leone today. That's one example. But on the other side, understanding the patterns of corruption, but also the dynamics of the discourse around corruption in those countries, if we have a heightened understanding of the perceptions of Afghans, of the Taliban, I'm not saying that the Taliban were necessarily less corrupt, but they were perceived as being less corrupt. It's a very important point to bear in mind, considering the perceptions, and I'll come back to that, of Afghans of corruption in the Karzai administration today. So that's one point about understanding the pre-reconstruction patterns of corruption. The second point is corruption and reconstruction. Three elements that we would focus on. The first one is the notion of buying the peace. Now, the notion of buying the peace is something where there's been comparatively little research looking at it from a corruption angle in terms of when it is or not so much justifiable as necessary and useful in the long term. Now, some of the most famous examples, Mozambique, Remamo, but also Lebanon and Afghanistan. Now, Mozambique presents what some might probably look at the best example of financial incentives produced by the international community, most notably the Italian government, in order to bring the opposition party, Renamo, into democratic politics. Now, Mozambique at this point remains a stable government, but there's a very strong argument put forth by our local partners that the lack of transparency and the lack of accountability in the way that the trust fund for Renamo was done informed the lack of accountability in the government in Mozambique throughout the 90s and up until today. So that's one question that hasn't been asked really up until now. The second point is Afghanistan and what has been the consequences of the Karzai government's policy of co-option of the warlords into the transition process in December and in 2002 and onwards. That's the first point. The second point is really the nature of the tension between diplomatic gains and developmental gains in post-war settings. And that's something which, again, our expertise is not in reconstruction. Our expertise is on governance in developmental settings. And this is something that's different, that state actors in those settings are tacitly or overtly allowed to reap the benefits of peace. I mean, for example, most donors turning a blind eye to corruption in the PNA throughout the 90s, corruption in Fatah, which, while the internal demands for accountability that existed in the early 1990s then grew with the consequences that we know later on. And that's the second point. The third point is, in the nature of the projects, if it's something that we looked at an earlier stage, looking at corruption in construction, for example, in the construction sector in those countries, what we'd underestimated, it seems now from the research that we have, is the political nature of the gains that are made by corruption in post-war settings, that corruption is used to gain financially, but also politically. I mean, examples, for example, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, just a small example, balancing projects. donors entering a particular locality, talking to a local power holder, and in exchange for being given access to have to do a balancing project, build a road, build probably not a school, but build a road, build a building, etc. The point that came back again, time and again, from the countries we worked in is donors entering the countries in a post-natural disaster mode. Now, I don't want to simplify the complexities of dealing with corruption in humanitarian settings, and this is something that we've looked at tangentially. But the point being to understand the political dynamics of dealing with local power holders in those settings, and this is not something that's been done, that's been understood particularly well up until now. So, from this understanding, and there's more in the paper, from this understanding of corruption, our question is, so what has an anti-corruption policy response been? Well, at this point, it's striking how little there's been. I mean, considering the degree of prominence of the corruption issue in the developmental agenda, there's extraordinarily little. You could by and large say that apart from Sierra Leone, anti-corruption work really starts in these countries after 3, 4, 5 years. Now, what I mean by anti-corruption is policies that have an explicit, as an explicit object, the fight against corruption. So generally anti-corruption commissions, anti-corruption strategy. I'll come back to broader governance reforms later on. So what is striking in those particular settings? Strategies. In many of the countries, there was an effort on the part of the donors largely, partly the government, to kickstart anti-corruption strategies, a strategic understanding of how they could explicitly fight corruption. What's striking is the degree to which this was extraordinarily difficult to do. These strategies never took off the ground, essentially. They didn't take off. They're still not taking off the ground in Afghanistan, and they never took off the ground in Bosnia. Anti-corruption commissions. This is something that we're starting to understand a little better, which is by and large the failure of anti-corruption commissions on the Hong Kong model in most developmental settings. And this is something that's very true in post-war settings, be they commissions that were very well funded, such as the Sierra Leone one, and that largely failed because of executive interference, lack of political will, but really lack of incentives. And the second point being commissions that were less well funded, but equally ineffective in Afghanistan and Mozambique, partly because anti-corruption commissions rely on the rest of the system to work. If the judiciary doesn't work, if the attorney general doesn't work, the scope of the commission to actually do some work is very limited. I mean, the achievement so far of the Mozambican anti-corruption commission has to be arresting two people who were charged for stealing $500. I mean, if you contrast that with an analysis of corruption saying administrative corruption is a problem, but high-level corruption is a huge problem in those countries, we really need different tools to be able to target it. Now, why is it that there's been relatively little attention paid to the problem in post-war settings? We'd say for three reasons, perhaps. One of them is relatively little donor interest in cases where diplomatic imperatives prime. That's the argument of working with Fatah in the 90s in the West Bank and Gaza. But also a conceptualization by donors of the corruption problem as financial accountability. When the issue came on the floor, the issue was one of protecting donor funds rather than actual accountability to the beneficiaries, which is what our partners were more interested in. Second point is that there's relatively little interest on the part of the first post-war governments to tackle this issue. I mean, they might not be elected. They might be transitional power-sharing administrations, or they might have been elected, but most likely not to fight corruption in the first place. And then the third point, and in some ways, I mean, the overarching point, is very little understanding of the fit. So security, public institution building, humanitarian needs, economic development. Where does corruption fit in within that? And that's a real lack of understanding of where the corruption issue fits, and this is what we've been trying to do. Now, the question is, if governments and donors have a limited interest, who does have an interest? Well, local communities and opposition movements. And this is the point that I touched on in the graph earlier. In the countries for which we have data, corruption perceptions increased, right? Most strikingly in Palestine, you have an incremental increase. 50% of Palestinians thought that the PA was corrupt in 96 to 85% in 2005, just before the election of Hamas in January 2006. In Afghanistan, in some data that comes from our partner in Kabul, Integrity Watch Afghanistan, that we helped fund 2 years ago, and this is based on the sample of 1,400 respondents throughout Afghanistan in regions which were secure enough for them to go, 60% of Afghans thought that the Karzai government was the most corrupt government ever, with consequences that one can imagine in terms of legitimacy, of a government which is struggling to get legitimacy outside of Kabul. Now, the point, as I mentioned earlier, is that corruption is used as a political discourse by opposition movements in those countries, but also that the way that the opposition movements tackle the issue isn't strictly focusing on corruption. It's a mixture of things. It's corruption, transparency, accountability for some of them, but also service delivery, saying, right, this doesn't work, we have a way to make it work. It's in parallel to the state and it works better. This is what's happening. Even in Afghanistan, with the Taliban setting up parallel courts, in Palestine, Hezbollah doing reconstruction basically themselves in the south of Lebanon, which is something that we'll be looking at. The point being that if the state loses legitimacy, the state loses the monopoly of the use of violence, hence the risk, the link to instability in those particular settings. Now, I haven't been keeping track on time enough, but three things that we wanted to look at in terms of accountability mechanisms in those settings, and then I'll come to actually what we think we can do and what does work in those settings. So first talking about horizontal accountability mechanisms, then vertical accountability mechanisms, moving on to diagonal or social accountability, which I'll talk about. First of all, without wanting to go into too much detail, now, horizontal accountability mechanisms, right, so legislatures, judiciaries, etc., were relatively weak in those settings. Obviously, extremely weak states, weak institutional infrastructures, but at the same time, they were also under-prioritized. I mean, again, the example of Afghanistan, the judicial sector in Afghanistan accounts now for 3% of security sector reform. By contrast, police reform is about 28%. Army reform is 60%. I've talked to the UK government about this, and the response has been largely, right, now this is fine, but the judiciary in Afghanistan never really worked. Why should we spend money on that particular point? Well, the point being that one needs to target the reforms that are closest to some of the communities, and this is exactly what the Taliban are doing in terms of setting up parallel courts, and that there are innovations. I mean, there are examples in Sierra Leone and other ones, small-scale innovations in the judicial sector in order for us to learn how can we understand better the balance between statutory and customary law in Sierra Leone, for example. That's not happening. Learning in terms of how judicial reform works in fragile states isn't happening at this point enough. Moving on, in terms of vertical accountability mechanisms. Now, what's interesting here is this is a field where successes have been, rather than in the field that I was talking about just now, elections, right? We've had comparative success in setting up elections, but also, and interestingly, building the capacity of local electoral commissions in post-war settings. Now, as you know better than I do, the problem with elections is that they don't give legitimacy to the government in a sustainable fashion. Elections come, expectations rise, and then the work needs to continue. So whereas elections present an extremely important part of accountability mechanisms, it's by no means the only one. The same goes for the media. The other successful, really, vertical accountability reform in those settings is media reform. Now, I don't want to go over the top in terms of talking about successes of the media, but in comparison, media in those countries does present one of the crucial accountability mechanisms. But in and of itself, media isn't enough in order to involve communities to be able to have accountability at different levels. So before I go on to talking about the social accountability level, just to talk about accountability and aid, one of the fundamental points about these countries is what we term the dual accountability system, that the governments are both accountable to their citizens, right, but also accountable as recipients of aid, accountable to the US, the UK, and to their principles. And it's that dilemma that we need to be able to bridge. At this point, the result of that dilemma is that the efforts of the donors are focusing on financial accountability of the funds, which isn't necessarily what the beneficiaries of the aid would want the donor community to focus on. The second point is that the transparency, the understanding, the coordination of the aid is relatively poor. It was incredibly difficult for the organizations working with us, and these are English-speaking organizations in the capitals, to actually understand what was happening in their country in terms of the aid. Now, there's been a significant amount of work in creating donor assistance databases, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. In Afghanistan, the donor assistance database is extraordinarily difficult to come to terms with for us, so one can imagine for Afghans in the provinces. Now, what's interesting to us is that where there have been successes, they've been at the community level, at the local level, in participatory community development programs. Now, the most famous of them being the National Solidarity Program, but others in Sierra Leone, in Kosovo, the Community Development Fund. What's interesting is that these community level programs aren't seen at this point as accountability programs. They're not seen as programs that could actually fight corruption. If one starts to look at those programs as programs that can promote transparency, accountability, as anti-corruption programs, a whole universe, essentially, of policy solutions becomes apparent that's not apparent right now. And what is interesting is that the civil society programs in those countries aren't really, at this point, taking advantage of those successes. Civil society programs, by and large, focus on mostly service delivery, mostly. And in democracy assistance, elections, human rights and media, there's very, very few organizations that are working on governance and accountability issues in those countries. And the few organizations that do exist are largely in the capital, not at the community level where the most work can actually be done, we would argue. Now, what does that mean? One of the reasons for the lack of investment might be lack of an understanding of the links between accountability and stability, which was the point that I was making earlier on. And we would argue that a way of understanding, a way of being able to prioritize, to see the policy solution in those countries, is to look at the local competences in the countries, to look at the relation between local capacities in country and accountability mechanisms. Now, for this to happen, we need to understand better what local competences exist in the country. So, briefly, to talk about local competences, we need to know a lot better what strength we can draw on in the particular countries. Time and time again, this comes from the local organizations working with us, that the organizations coming, especially in the potlatch phase, in the first few years, have very little understanding on how to draw on the capacities of the country, whereas there are capacities in the country. It's obviously difficult administratively to be able to work with them, but at this point, we're not investing enough time in understanding how we could overcome that administrative hurdle. The point about local competences isn't that they're necessarily better, but they're there. So in that sense, they're foundational. They're something to work with. It's local knowledge that we don't necessarily have in those settings. Now, what's interesting is that what we know about local competences, and this comes from the community development programs, is that we get increased sustainability and efficiency from working at the local level. Our point is that you also get increased accountability. You can get increased accountability and a reduction of corruption. So that's the point. The point is that when it's used, it's worked at the local community level, and it's a learning process. And this is the point that I was mentioning earlier about knowledge transfer. In order for this to happen, we need to be able to look at what's happening beyond the radar screen, beyond donor projects, actually instances of reconstruction that might not be led by donors. And in order for that to happen, we have to have a knowledge transfer mechanism which is a lot more based south-south. Twinnings, mentoring programs between Timorese and Mozambicans, between Afghans and Lebanese, etc. And at this point, this isn't happening. Now, what does that mean for us in terms of good governance and the good enough governance agenda in fragile states? The problem, the holy grail in terms of governance in post-war reconstruction settings is how to prioritize. We recognize at this point that the good governance agenda presents us with essentially too broad a palette, too broad a menu of things to do in those settings. So we understand that we need to cut down, but the point is how to cut down on it, how to prioritize, how can we prioritize on the key issues in terms of anti-corruption, in terms of governance. Now, one of the ways of doing that, we would argue, is to look at the relation between local competencies and accountability mechanisms, because they're there in those countries, and we can harness those strengths, especially at the local level. In countries where the higher level, the political level, is extremely difficult to work with, doesn't present obvious entry points, there are real opportunities at the local level that aren't being taken advantage of at this point. And briefly, I mean, again, our expertise hasn't been so far in post-war reconstruction settings. We work with the post-war reconstruction and development unit at York University in the United Kingdom. We're trying to understand the linkages between reconstruction and theories of reconstruction and the model of integrity that we're working with. Now, looking at one possible model for reconstruction, one assumes the need for a shared strategic vision, an understanding, continuous reflection, an understanding that reconstruction should be imposed from within, collaborative governance, inducing economic development, and reconciliation and justice as really four main components of an approach to reconstruction. How does this lens help us in those settings? Well, what we would argue is that precisely it is a lens, it is a way of prioritizing and looking within each one of those pillars what one might do, how one might do it. In some ways, it's a bit like the conflict sensitivity approach. It's a way of doing it. It's not an objective in and of itself, as anti-corruption is. We want to achieve zero corruption. It's a way of doing it. It's reform through integrity. It's a way of being able to harness local capacities and accountability mechanisms in country. So, briefly finishing up, what does it mean in practice? And this is real, very much a work in progress, and I'd be interested for your comments, and I'm talking to a variety of different audiences about this. Well, one of the points is really to understand, support, and institutionalize social accountability through participatory mechanisms and access to information at the local level. One of the ways of doing it could be to implement national solidarity-type programs in those countries, but also to look a lot further and what do those programs actually tell us about accountability and how can we use them to monitor the process. One of the striking things in post-war settings for us is that there's very little monitoring that's going on. There's extraordinary little monitoring on the point of view of the donors, but also on the point of view of the recipients. Whereas in developmental settings, organizations such as the International Budget Project and others have been looking at community monitoring of the budgetary process. In post-war settings, there's essentially nothing. And this is really what we're trying to understand, how we can do this. And this is a process that we're doing with the network. We'll be doing it in South Lebanon, working with municipalities. We'll be working with essentially what's there, working at the local level, working with the community development councils in Afghanistan and other groups. Now, another point in terms of accountability recommendations is to do no harm, that monitoring can actually be very disempowering for organizations. The point is to get accountability through the institutions. The point isn't to start watchdog organizations, different civil society organizations that can blow the whistle on a very weak state, but rather to work to encourage citizen participation in the reconstruction process. One of the arguments, briefly as well, is in order to be able to have increased information, to think about innovative tools and techniques to encourage transparency and accountability of the donor funding so we know what actually happens. It's incredibly difficult at this point to look at, for example, South Lebanon is a good example with a variety of different donors there, Qatar, Emirates and others, to understand what's happening. And briefly in terms of competences, and these are more than actually recommendations, these are really a few ideas, to create twinnings between regional universities and institutes of public administrations. I mean, this would be a very fast way to be able to train civil servants in large numbers in those settings. We're working with universities in the Middle East and other areas. This is something which we don't know enough about. To use multi-donor trust funds to slow and sustain the disbursement of aid to fragile states. Now, a lot of people have been saying this, but it's obviously one of the ways to be able to work through it. To use local contractors whenever possible. What's interesting is that in the cases that we've looked at of working with local contractors, the traditional obstacle to working with local contractors is actually corruption. But in the cases that we've looked at, there's actually been more accountability in working with local contractors than the other way around. Now, obviously, we haven't done the research in terms of quantitative data to be able to back that up, but the analysis that comes through, the qualitative analysis from the field, points to that. And lastly, in terms of competences, different ideas. We could create a mentoring system, twinning systems, where retired civil servants from countries in the region and countries which really are relevant administratively to those countries could come and support long-term to mentor them. Twinning is something that largely happened in the European Union accession process and isn't something that we're really doing in post-war countries and that we could look at doing. And lastly, favour value for money in reconstruction. I'll skip over these and I'll come back to them briefly. Really, part of the recommendations in terms of corruption is, and we're still working through them, is the risk with having a policy approach which is too geared towards anti-corruption is to focus on enforcement, and enforcement is incredibly difficult to do in those settings. And the risk to actually waste funding is very, very high. And the second risk is that what we're not advocating is large-scale awareness-raising campaigns, which we think that in those settings could actually be destabilizing rather than contribute to the stability of those countries. So those are a few of the ideas that I had. I'm sorry if I took more time than I had, and welcome your questions. Thanks. Not particularly, not so far. I mean, the point really of the databases is that in and of themselves, right now the database serves the donor community. The point is, how can we have, even the term database, I'm not sure it's a very happy one in terms of beneficiaries, how can we work in order to make the communities understand and work through what we're doing? So maybe the question isn't so much a centralized database for the aid, but rather how we can involve communities in the process of the aid in order to make it more accountable, in order to be able to make it more understandable. It's more about accessibility and understanding of what's happening rather than the figures in and of themselves from the point of view of the beneficiaries, we think.
Yes, Barbara Belay, the World Bank. I've worked on five of the countries in your case studies here, and I've also done some work on corruption issues, comparing the West Bank and Gaza and Bosnia. And what we found was relatively little misuse in donor funding because of the tight controls on donor funding, the multi-donor trust fund mechanism where you have internal controls built in. What we found was misuse of domestic resources in the form of taxes, customs, revenues, diaspora contributions, and things of that sort. So the misuse of the donor funding was really in the domestic revenues. And the donor community, in the case of the Palestinians, put very heavy pressure on Arafat at the time to reconcile the accounts and get rid of these off-budget accounts and put all of the accounts into a single treasury account in the Ministry of Finance. So that there was donor pressure. But you're right, the donors are much more concerned about transparency and accountability in the use of their own funds. One area where I did see some institution building and capacity building was in the creation of organizations in Lebanon, for example, the Council for Development and Reconstruction, and the similar council that was modeled on that, the Palestinian Economic Council for Development and Reconstruction, where there was a transfer of knowledge. There was an attempt to build local capacity in dealing mostly with donor funds, but, you know, it does carry over. I think the public did look at some of these projects and say, okay, they were done well. And then on the Hamas-Hezbollah, one of the things we noticed with the non-governmental organizations, I did the first survey of the NGOs in the West Bank and Gaza in 94, and we already saw that Hamas was running very, very good NGOs and social service delivery in education and health, and they were perceived as very clean and not corrupt. So just a few comments. Thank you.
No, I think so. To go backwards to answer your question, I mean, the National Solidarity Program in Afghanistan, I mean, in the areas that it works, in the areas that it works in, actually does use social accountability mechanisms. I mean, I think that the clever thing about the NSP, and this is what our case study has shown, and partly also the case study at York University on it, is that you have this mixture of social accountability mechanisms in the structure of the community development councils, right? Together with vertical accountability mechanisms in the regional international NGOs that are responsible for the disbursement of the funds. So I think that whereas in post-conflict environments, okay, in the south of Afghanistan, it's not quite possible to do right now, but in other cases where the stability is enough, one might not necessarily have the ready structures to work with. But what's amazing for us is actually setting up the structures in terms of the CDCs has enabled these social accountability mechanisms to flourish relatively fast. And I think that really, I mean, in this particular case, the thirst of the public and their understanding and their desire to change has really fueled that success. So I think that, I mean, in our, at this point, limited analysis, it has been possible. And this is really what we're exploring and experimenting with. I think that the problem that we're going to face in working in those particular areas, and we're going to start working in Liberia, DRC, and Sudan, is the notion of sort of peacetime ethics versus sort of post-war ethics, and what's possible and what's not in terms of monitoring, and how eager people are going to be in the immediate post-war phase to really start wanting to go out and ask questions. I think it's going to be one thing for us to do it in Lebanon, Palestine, Afghanistan, but another thing to do it in DRC and Liberia, and that's the real challenge that we face. In terms of your question, in terms of priorities, it's a big question. Why the international community doesn't prioritize? I mean, it seems to us that it's really a lack of conceptualization. It's a lack of theory of prioritization. That the approach that we have is still much too focused on models, saying that this is the way to do it. You know, we have to focus on 1, 2, 3. The way we do governance is we have these 6 pillars, and this is how we do it. The understanding of prioritization has to be rooted deeply in the context. And the fact is that the contextual nature of the assistance is, I think, really, I mean, what we've lost. I'm not sure we ever had it, but it's not what we have at this particular point in time. It's really that it's from an analysis of the context that the priorities will come up. So what we need is the tools and the mechanisms to be able to understand the context better. I'm not sure that's a very helpful answer, but that's the one that I would have right now. And in terms of your very, I mean, interesting points and comments, I think one thing that's interesting, just a short anecdote about sort of the work in Palestine and the single treasury account, is that, and this is an example that we've been looking at, is that around 2002, 2003, you had a combination of 3 things in the West Bank and Gaza that made these reforms possible. In our analysis, is internal demands for reform that grew stronger and stronger, especially 2 years into the Second Intifada, and people realized how weak the institutions were, combined with, yes, international demands for reform, right? But also combined with actually a willingness on the part of the government to do change, to act on those reforms at a time when the funding was low. And this is what's interesting. And this is the point, really, about the potlatch. It's when the funding was lowest that accountability issues could actually be acted upon. And then our question is, how can we get that at an earlier stage? How can we get it, you know, when the funding is actually coming forth?
Because you're forgetting the pressure that Salam Fayyad had. I mean, the prestige. I mean, it's right. Really his personality and his...
Yeah, sorry, so completely. So the fourth point is the role of individuals and the role of leaders, and Ashraf Ghani played a similar role in Afghanistan in the early stages. So, of course, yeah.
Hi,
So to address this under the first question, you were talking about the ways to sort of change that phenomenon in terms of the funding. I mean, I'm not sure that we're the best placed. I mean, we can put the issue out there together with a lot of other organizations. But in terms of a network of civil society organizations in those countries, what we can really do is, from an advocacy perspective, to put the issue out there. To work out really the details of how it can be done is really up to others. I mean, that's not where the strength and the value added we think of our network could be. But in terms of, do we accept it as a given? No. I mean, I think it can be changed. And partly, and we've been working some with the CIC at NYU, Bonnie Rubin and others on that, is to look at the distinction between pledges, commitments, and disbursements and how we could actually change that. So we can have a potlatch where we pledge a huge amount, but the question is really, how can we disperse it over time? And I think that it's within that that we can look at it. But then to work out the precise policy recommendations on that isn't quite where our value added it is, quite simply. The second point, it's so interesting, the point about Iraq. Iraq isn't a country, obviously, as you've seen, that we've worked on. I was talking with some Iraqis yesterday about this, and the issue, and this issue surfaced. No, it's not something that we've seen in the countries that we've worked in. And I mean, partly because anti-corruption wasn't the major political priority. But what's particularly, when it was the case in some of the countries that I know, I mean, for example, you could say that for Kenya to a degree in terms of anti-corruption, or Bulgaria or other countries. And this is something where we're really starting to scratch the surface. And it's the issue of the relation between not corruption but anti-corruption and stability. To what degree does the sequencing and prioritization of anti-corruption policies is actually destabilizing in and of itself? And I did some small research on that in Southeast Europe, and that's really something that we need to look at in a lot more depth. And part of the issue in terms of the recognition of that problem is what we're putting on the table here in terms of saying we don't need to look at it solely as a corruption problem, partly, and we could benefit from your analysis, but from a question of integrity. And time and time again, talking with experts at headquarter level, I'm very often told, no, look, the focus should be on corruption. You need to focus down. If you start talking about what you're doing now, you'll talk about aid effectiveness, and it'll be far too broad. But the bottom line is that for us, the local groups that we're working with, this is the interest that they have, and we have to deal with that. If that is the interest of the local communities, whether it fits or not into our conceptualization is one thing, but it is a reality on the ground that we need to deal with. And if we want to actually make change in those communities, we have to understand that reality, understand the problem in order to find solutions to it. So that's, I think, a very important point to bear in mind. In terms of your point about discretion, yes, I mean, it is a problem. It is a problem that comes up. It's a problem that's come up in Sierra Leone, and that's also something that we need to look at in a lot more depth, which is the question. We have this wonderful quote from one of the sort of senior-level government officials in Sierra Leone that says that the donor community, they tell us to drive the reconstruction process in Sierra Leone, but they keep the steering wheel, and that's something that really, again, I mean, I'm not sure that we're best placed to be able to tackle it, but to put the issue out there is really something that we need to do. And again, I mean, partly what we would say is that there's a huge emphasis on national level reconstruction in those countries, and really our point is to go local to a degree. I mean, it's not about, we don't want to avoid the national level. Obviously, I think the tension, I think partly in the work that we've done, is that on one hand we lay out sort of the self-criticism, I think, is on one hand we lay out corruption is really a high-level problem, political networks, etc., and then we say fine, but the solution at local level. So this is something that we need to work on, but partly what we're saying is really the local level is where we haven't looked at, and there's really some change that can happen at that particular level in those countries. And to your last point, Alix, in terms of looking at peace operations, yes, I mean, I think there are opportunities there, and I'll be talking with the Peace Building Commission in New York next week about it. It's not something that we've looked at too closely now, but I'm talking with DPKO and the Peace Building Commission looking at it. It's partly the nature of the countries that we've been working with, and really that would be a question to look at. I mean, it would have been a question to look at really in East Timor in the early stages and others, but I think, yes, I mean, I think the... And I just walked out of a meeting with the Wilson Center and their work on peace building, and I think that's really something that we need to look at. I mean, as much as there was very little work in the anti-corruption community in reconstruction settings, there's very little work in terms of anti-corruption community in reconstruction settings and then the peace building community. And this is something that we really need to look at. And that's partly what I was mentioning in terms of peacetime ethics and sort of, you know, post-war ethics, and how we can actually, what we're going to do is to try, which we are trying to do with the network, is to try and encourage local monitoring of reconstruction. How can we actually train people to do this? And then we have to look at peace-building techniques in doing that, I think.
Well, I'll
I'll take your question first. To be honest, you can see in the case study, I mean, of the NSP, we're not. It's partly a thirst to try and find successes that we can be sort of slightly over-enthusiastic. I mean, part of the analysis is, you know, the capture of certain CDCs by local power holders and local warlords. And part of the issue is really how can we work against that, really, in terms of setting up third-party monitoring of CDCs, etc. So that's something, it's a problem that we acknowledge. I mean, the question that you're asking, I think, is an excellent one. I mean, the state is closing down. One of the most potent examples is in terms of media and media freedom in Afghanistan, and the statements of Karzai from last summer, really, up until now, saying, you know, at this point, this is the line, you can't do this. And so, I mean, it's a problem. I don't have a ready answer to it. But in terms of the gradual disintegration of it, I mean, I think it's a phenomenon, basically, that we have in terms of the curve, you know, the relation. And it's something that has to be tackled at a very early stage. And that's the point, really, of working both on bolstering state institutions and at the same time social accountability mechanisms. I don't think we're not really saying, I mean, it's a strength of our network. What we're saying isn't do that and disregard the rest, because otherwise I think we will end up, partly with bad security situations in the problem that you're identifying now in Afghanistan. So the two of them very much to go together. And again, on that point, in terms of the strength of the state institutions, what is striking in the research that we've done is judicial reform in those countries. And time again, this is one of the main problems that comes up. It comes up in East Timor, it comes up in Afghanistan, comes up in Palestine, etc. This is really the one sort of element that comes up. To come back to the question just earlier, in terms of working with local contractors, this is something that we're refining. We would see it at the different levels, community, district, and provincial level. I mean, it's not in terms of what we're saying isn't really that corruption risks are necessarily sort of lowered by working with local contractors. I mean, in some cases, it's certainly not the case. But it's rather that it's about local competencies. If the local contractors are there, they need to be reckoned with and they need to be used in some way or another. And we need to be able to do it rather than just actually use them as the very last, you know, cog in a subcontracting chain. And that's something that we need to reckon with. Local monitoring, I mean, you're talking about the culture of impunity. Yes, I mean, that I think is sort of linked to sort of learning lessons in terms of training and how to do local monitoring, lessons from training in terms of peace building, you know, and sort of the process, how we can do that, how we can get people to ask these questions and engage in those types of mechanisms. And it's a learning process, really. I mean, there's none of this happening right now. And if you have, I mean, very seriously, if you have any ideas of places we should look at right now, I'd welcome them very much, because it's a pilot, it's something that we have to put together basically from scratch. Your question dealing with the PRTs. Now, to be completely frank, we haven't looked at the PRTs yet in great depth, so I'm not the best person to answer that question. What I have done, though, is some sort of work with the Canadian military a little bit in terms of some interviews and talking to them. What strikes me, and I might be completely wrong, is that one of the problems is, how do you identify local power holders? And I was asking them, and I was really pushing them to say, do you have a methodology? How do you do it? And I might be wrong, but my impression is that there is no methodology, no way of actually being able to identify local power holders in those settings. And that would be sort of my sort of entry point in terms of understanding the role that they can play in those particular settings. I might be wrong, though. That's based on very little information. Your point is an excellent one in terms of, I mean, sort of overburdening and sharing lessons. But I think the point really is how we can use it operationally, you know, rather than just a side thought, oh, well, at the same time, it would be nice to really talk about how you did it in Lebanon, but really to involve, you know, to have a cadre, as it were, of civil servants from those countries who are able to intervene in different situations. I mean, a lot of this thinking, I've been doing some work with the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Unit in the UK government, and I just had a meeting with CSRS in, At the State Department just this morning, and there's a lot of the thinking behind those units. I mean, how can we have, you know, a ready deployment of people who know the terrain? So I think, yes, I mean, the emphasis isn't, there's an emphasis on sharing lessons, but really, how can we make it operational in those settings? And quite frankly, as you said, I mean, we're talking about 500 people who are overburdened, who have too much, but also don't know the terrain perhaps as well as they would want to know it. And that's why they're all sort of focusing on one particular individual. And hence, really, the point of looking at the local competences within the country. I mean, we have, again, on a slight joke, we asked for some sort of data, different data from some of our countries, and in Kosovo, they were telling us that the EU pillar in Kosovo, amongst their drivers, 80% of their drivers had BAs, and the rest had MAs and PhDs. I mean, this is something that really has to be reckoned with. Another small, I mean, you're more aware of this than I mean, when I was looking for organizations with research capacity in Afghanistan, I couldn't find any civil society organizations to work with at first. We basically spoke to every single one under the sun and ones involved with the NSP and one not. And I talked to this one organization and they were all eager to work with. They didn't care what, obviously, I mean, they didn't care what we were doing. Yes, we'll work with you, which is always a sort of, the ones that weren't eager to work with us, I was eager to work with them, and then they didn't want to. But And this one organization said, yes, it's fine, we have research capacity. And I was like, but you're a healthcare NGO, but how do you mean? Oh, but all our drivers are teachers, don't worry. And that's one of the problems. And so.
One other question. Have you linked notions of accountability with the causes of conflict? In other words, accountability is not just about financial rectitude and auditing and adhering to procurement. It also concerns equitable distribution of the peace benefits. So to what extent have you dealt with accountability in terms of linking it back to the causes of conflict and perceptions among different ethnic groups or sectarian groups that one group may be favored over another?
You know, to take the last question first, no, I mean, that's something that we need to be looking at. It's not, I mean, part of our research is incredibly broad at this point and could go in, I mean, you could write really 15 different papers from the draft paper that you'll see. And part of really our emphasis is to get, you know, some critical mass building up on looking at that. So if particular institutions are interested, we don't really have the capacities to do this type of work. And really our focus now is going to be working on sort of monitoring with those local groups. But if different institutions are interested in that kind of work, I mean, that's exactly the outcome that we would like to see from our work. To answer your question in terms of where it might not work, I don't think it's necessarily a sort of a universal prescription, but it's something that might be considered at least in all situations. I think very clearly why Where it might not work, the typical example is Rwanda, right? I mean, and I think that that's something that we need to look at, you know, in a lot more detail and how that would work on one hand. And on the other hand is, I think, just in highly insecure environments. I mean, in some areas in Iraq, I mean, I'm not sure that's particularly relevant in those cases. But again, I mean, it's a theory that has to be tested, is our point, and it's something that seems to work. And the interesting point, I think, and I don't want to make too much out of that, because we're really not saying that sort of, you know, Hamas is acting with integrity, but there is something very politically powerful about this combination. Now, you take the case of Hamas, you know, they were to some degree, they weren't accountable, but they were ready to become accountable through entering the political process. They were saying at least that they were transparent and accountable, and they delivered. That's all really, I mean, pointing what we're pointing to. You have a very politically powerful combination in those three elements, and that's what we're saying. Related to your question, no, I completely agree. On the relation between accountability and the causes of conflict, I think in the cases that we've used, the one where we've looked at that the most is Lebanon. Very much. And we did a case study of the Elisar project, the project sort of reconstructing the southern suburbs of Beirut. And I think that's one of the clearest examples where, you know, lack of accountability, relations between the peace settlement, different segments of the community actually contributed to then fragilize reconstruction in that particular setting. Exactly. So, and we are looking at that. We're working with the Lebanese Center for Policy Studies in Beirut and different, as I said, communities and municipalities in the south in order to understand what's happening. And what seems to us interesting there is that as information is a commodity. And if you look at what Hezbollah is doing in those suburbs and in the south, it's about that commodity. What Hezbollah says is, you know, these communities, we represent you, you know, we are working for your interests. What's interesting is that potentially it puts the communities in a very powerful situation to say, if you were to turn around and say, actually, no, that's not my interest, and my interest is this, well, where does Hezbollah stand without looking sort of, you know, overly authoritarian? And I mean, we need to be careful in doing this, but this is something that we will be doing with our partners, we'll be doing with our partners in the south, and to try and get some information, to try and get, you know, behind sort of reconstruction jihad and what's happening in some of the villages and say, well, actually, have you been involved? I mean, this is good. You know, they purport to be, you know, this and that, but have you been involved? Is this what you would like to see happen? Do you know what's happening? Do you have the information? So this is something that really needs to be looked at in some more depth. No, I think very much. I mean, we are, I mean, to a degree, we're picking up the pieces in some ways. I mean, there have been some successes, but that's the situation we face now. I mean, the learning curve was extremely steep in the 1990s in this type of work. And what's interesting, I mean, to be completely honest, I mean, in the countries that we've looked at, it's not a big surprise that it's around 2000 that the governance issue really came to the fore, because it's around 2000 that the governance issue came to the fore really in development settings anyway, and in part with some World Bank publications and others. So it's a learning curve not only in sort of reconstruction settings, but in development settings themselves. So yes, I mean, to a degree, we are picking up the pieces, but the learning curve has been very steep.